activity of every enzyme and see if we can recover some of the activities that we are finding into the termite gene, into the termite guts, I'm sorry. Okay? So that's my conclusion. We have a very, very promising set of termite genes that are likely involved in wood digestion and assimilation. And that's considering not only the glycohydrolase, which I focused on, but we're also interested in doing the type of work with the lignases. And so we are looking at hundreds of enzymes, potentially. So we have that tool now to detail wood digestion and assimilation. And you see some of the further direction that I already mentioned. So phylogenetic analysis, some gene expression data, knowing exactly which gene is expressed where in the gut, and generation of enzyme, looking at enzyme activity and what occurs actually in the gut. On top of that, I'm annotating all the ESTs, so 3,000 or so that we have generated, and we just kickstart in over Thanksgiving the sequencing of the SymBiont library. Those sequences are coming in, so I'm going to be able to compare everything and do more annotation. So that list of enzymes that are involved into wood assimilation is growing and growing, and hopefully going to be fully characterized at some point. I was only involved into the bioinformatics of the side of the project, so I didn't get to play with termites at all. So I need to acknowledge everybody that actually dissected some guts. We also have some technical support from University of Florida, as well as some financial support. Okay, and with that, I thank you for your attention, and I'll be happy to take any questions. With ATC and Gs. But I'm sure you'll find somebody in our groups that can answer your question if you're really interested.
Yeah, it's a symbiont. The termites can't live without the symbiont.
I understand. My question is, in order to take a piece of the wood, they have to put it into the gut. Do they liquefy it first and get some semi-liquefied polymer, break down the starch, which is a long polymer that has the beta, if you know what the glucose structure is, a beta, there's an alpha and beta. The beta is unique to cellulose, because cellulose is not miscible. How do they do? Is it break small chains, so they have to liquefy them, get it in, or they take a small particle, get it in, and then work on it inside the gut?
Well, I ever do it. It doesn't really change the set of genes that they are using. So
well,
you know, there's going to be some enzyme.
Might go to the saliva. It might have some of the enzyme in saliva.
Yeah, but since the gut that we dissected includes the salivary glands, supposedly all the genes that are produced by the salivary gland cells are in our library as well. Yes. It's possible that yes, some of the genes that we identified as being potentially involved in wood degradation would not be. Okay, that's part of the reason why we want to test every enzyme in enzymatic assays. Okay, Nevertheless, you can imagine a scenario since, you know, Drosophila and termites are, you know, they're obviously not the same insects. So, you know, there's going to be a set of genes that they use for different functions. So maybe the termite uses a particular lignase gene to degrade wood. Drosophila uses it for, you know, who knows what. Yes? Yes, you mean that the blast analysis don't really provide a fairly accurate image of what the phylogeny of the genes are. That's possible. That would involve, checking everything would involve looking at every single gene one by one, meaning the 3,000 of them, and running some phylogenetic analysis. So that's not something that we are willing to do at some point.
Today I'm going to talk about some research we conducted this past summer involved with pyrethroid resistance in populations of the annual bluegrass weevil from Connecticut golf courses. This work was done in collaboration with Dr. Stephen Ohm's lab at the University of Rhode Island and Dr. Richard Coles' lab at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. For those of you who don't know too much about the annual bluegrass weevil, it's kind of an inconspicuous little weevil. It's primarily a pest of close-cut poannu on golf courses and tennis courts throughout the Northeast. In Connecticut, this translates specifically into the insect being a pest of golf courses. When populations are high in the summer months, when weevils are most active, you could have a tremendous amount of damage. Additionally, since poannua is a cool season turf grass, it's already under a tremendous amount of heat stress in the summer months, so any additional feeding by the annual bluegrass weevil further compounds the situation. Adult weevils emerge from their overwintering sites in the springtime, around mid-April. At this time, they actively seek out stands of poannua, as well as mates. And at the bottom picture, you can see the feeding of the adult is relatively inconsequential, and they cause a little damage. After they've found mates during the early spring, they lay their eggs within the stems of the poannua plant. You can see in the far corner. After the eggs hatch, the first three of five larval stages will feed inside the plant stems. These stages leave the one plant stem after it's outgrown that and enter a second plant stem, and they do this several times throughout these first three instar stages. The last two of the total five instar stages leave the stems altogether and move into the crown of the plant, and at this point they probably cause the most damage because the crown is the area from which new plant growth is initiated. So the fourth and fifth instar stage will feed primarily on the stem, on the crown of the plant, excuse me. As you can see, the damage can be pretty extensive around greens. They can also damage fairways, they can damage on the greens and approaches. These insects are so specific, they'll actually leave stands of bent grass, the green areas, move over it, move into poannua, and feed specifically on the poannua. So, control of the insect has primarily been achieved by chemical means. Pre-1970s, chlorinated hydrocarbons were used, and most of them were banned in the early 70s. Since the early 70s to the late 80s, organophosphates were used, and some organophosphates are still used today. Since the early 1990s to today, pyrethroids have been used. And according to Vitamin Coles, within the past few years, signs of pyrethroid ineffectiveness have been reported. And this has been primarily reported by golf course superintendents. So the best way to control the insects is you make your application of whatever chemical you choose in the early springtime to coincide with emergence of adult weevils. If you miss this, you'll probably have a lot of problems throughout the summer. Most superintendents miss this. They don't monitor enough to make their applications when adult weevils are present. And since the insect is multivoltine, you can very easily see how they would fall into the trap of having several applications per summer. In one golf course, we had 16 applications by August of a pyrethroid, and she never had any control. Looking at field efficacy data from one golf course in Hartford, Connecticut, conducted by Stephen Ohm's lab at URI. So you can see from 1996 to 2004, 2005, we had a well above 80% control using pyrethroid. However, between 2005 and 2007, which coincides with reports by superintendents of diminishing pyrethroid effectiveness, you can see according to our data on one golf course, during this period, it was also expressed in our field trials. So 2007, from down to 60% from above 80% the previous year. So with all this in mind, we wanted to conduct toxicity bioassays using several weevil populations from Connecticut golf courses for probably the two most commonly used active ingredients, bifenthrin and lambda-cyhalothrin. Once we were able to conduct toxicity bioassays, we used this data to determine LD50s for each population and each pesticide. And then we compared these LD50s in order to establish resistance ratios. Excuse me. So, this is a map of Connecticut, and you can see we have a pretty representative sample from all over the state. What we wanted to find were three types of golf courses. One, we wanted to find golf courses that had no pyrethroid use in the past several years. Two, we wanted to find golf courses that had low pyrethroid use, meaning two or less applications for the past several years. And we wanted to find golf courses that had high pyrethroid use, meaning two or more applications for the past several years. More likely, the high pyrethroid uses were above eight applications for the entire summer. As you can see, we had a hard time finding golf courses with no pyrethroid use. We only found one. We had a relatively easy time finding golf courses with high pyrethroid use. So you can see that the problem is pretty extensive throughout the state of Connecticut. So I would actually go to these golf courses, collect weevils by hand. You can actually collect weevils using a soap drench method and a vacuum method, but we didn't want to confound our toxicity results any. So collected weevils by hand, and these are hundreds of weevils. So it's a lot of effort in the field collecting weevils. Then we brought them back to the lab. We had several different concentrations of lambda-cyhalothrin and bifenthrin, technical grade quality insecticide. We applied 1 microliter of different concentrations to the intersegmental membrane of the insect, which separates the elytra from the prothorax. We stored these at 25 degrees Celsius, and after 24 hours, we counted or scored these for mortality. So you can see on the picture in the petri dish, any movement at all is considered alive, and no movement is considered death. So we didn't do 96 hours and wait for them to come back alive. We just scored at 24 hours. So this is how our data came out. Once we got the toxicity data from the petri dishes, we then used probit analysis, the PROC probit feature in SAS. And as you can see, we initially hypothesized that no pyrethroid use golf courses would have lower LD50s and high pyrethroid use golf courses. And you can see it pretty much worked out that way. The LD50 table in the middle, you see the grassmare had no pyrethroid history of no pyrethroid use, and they exhibited the lowest LD50 compared to all of the high pyrethroid use golf courses, which is statistically the same based on a failure to overlap of their 95% fiduciary limits. What is probably the most important part to take away from this table is looking at the far column, which says double R means resistance ratio. This was calculated by simply dividing the most susceptible population into the highest population, the highest LD50 population. So you can see at Hartford, it takes 93.9 times more pyrethroids to get their LD50 than it does for grassmere. And this is the result for bifenthrin. The results are similar for lambda-cyhalothrin. There may be some changes in the order of the high pyrethroid use golf courses, but again, Hartford was had the highest level of resistance. Grassmere, again, had the lowest level of resistance. The low golf courses, Grassmere and Yale, for both bifenthrin and lambda-cyhalothrin, were statistically the same. And again, all the high pyrethroid use golf courses in this case are statistically the same. And in this case, looking at lambda-cyhalothrin, Hartford exhibited 112 times more. It needed 112 times more pyrethroids to derive the same LD50. So with this in mind, we want to find out what the mode of resistance is. And since weevils are around just for 3 or 4 months in the summertime, it's hard to collect enough data to do everything at once. So you have to do it in successive years. But we had enough data, enough weevils from a resistant population, to using Fisher's exact test to do a small analysis to determine what we think the mode of resistance is. So looking at our boxes here, you see this again is a resistant golf course for pyrethroid. So on the first one, which is this one here, so we had I guess I should explain what mixed function oxidases are. So mixed function oxidases are enzymes within the insect that would break down any toxins, and they're natural in probably all organisms. The most common of these is cytochrome P450. You can block cytochrome P450 activity with a chemical called propionyl rotoxide, and this is basically what we did here. So that first box that I was talking about, so you have no pyrethroid, no PBO, so obviously they're all going to be alive. The second one, you have propionyl rotoxide and no pyrethroid. Again, they're all going to be alive because PBO is inactive. It's not a toxin. So this box, the last box on the 12 here, I'm sure you can, yeah, that one. So here we have pyrethroids and no PBO. And since the population is resistant, they were all alive. At the far box, we have a PBO and a pyrethroid. And the PBO mixed with the pyrethroid returned a resistant population to complete susceptibility, so they all died. So we think that most likely the mode of resistance is based on mixed function oxidases. We can't say 100% it's cytochrome P450, because it could be something like glutathione S-transferase or a carboxyl esterase. This will just take more work, and this is what we intend on doing in the next couple of years. So in conclusion, the high pyrethroid usage golf courses we looked at exhibited populations resistant to both lambda-cyhalothrin and bifenthrin. The mechanism of resistance, we think, is based on a mixed function oxidase. Again, we need to do more work involved with glutathione S-transferase and cytochrome P450 to determine which of those are acting most. And finally, we want to evaluate new methods of control, biological control methods, nematodes, fungi, and also new chemistries. And this, the last two are our plans for the next 2 years. So that's it.
We have time for a couple of questions.
You have some concerns on the collecting new multi-vectors, so threads or vacuum. So that's why you went through this hand. What would be the concern with the vacuum?
I actually conducted LD50s initially with the vacuum, and the for some reason the weevils were dying, and we got a lower LD50 than what we should have got. So for each of those tables, repeated it four times. The first one was lower than the last three, and the first set was collected by vacuum. So, and the same for the soap drench method. I think the guys at Cornell say they live for months, but I haven't had them live for more than a couple of days after using soap drench.
In commercial applications, do they use PBO?
There are actually some, I think MGK has some products with PBA, but it's not listed on the label, so they could potentially get in trouble with that. But there's a few companies in Florida you can buy straight PBO.
But do the ones used on golf course, do they use PBO? Or
there right now there are no major applications of PBO on golf courses, but I think this is such a big problem in New England that most likely you're going to see products with PBO coming out in the next 5 or 6 years. Looking at the ones with the PBO, they all died?
Yeah.
What was the question?
Why do you think of
Oh, why do I think it's also glutathione? Yeah. Okay, I think it's glutathione S-transferase, because if you look at the succession of applications, it was first hydrogenated chlorinated hydrocarbons, then organophosphates, and then pyrethroids. We believe that they're also resistant to organophosphates, and organophosphate resistance is derived primarily from glutathione S-transferase. So we think that there is a heterogeneous mixture of these in the insect.
Okay. Thanks.
So Lacrosse virus is a member of the family Bunyaviridae, genus Orthobunyavirus, and a member of the California group of seroviruses. It's transmitted by treehole mosquitoes, Acleratidus triceratus, and Aedes albopictus. Lacrosse encephalitis is typically asymptomatic and results in a mild febrile illness. But among a group of pediatric children, which the majority of patients are under 15,
In the 1930s, researchers in Florida and research in Michigan separately decided to put primary effluent into natural wetlands to see what would happen. And amazingly enough, the water that came out was stripped of a lot of the excess nutrients and the excess bacteria that were going into that with the effluent. Since that time, wetlands have been created across our country for treatment of primary and secondary effluent, and this makes for wonderful areas in Southern California, particularly for our nice waterfowl to migrate up the coast, particularly when we have such degradation of our natural wetlands. However, as this crowd also knows, it's a very great habitat for mosquitoes to breed in, and I know I don't have to tell this crowd about how we need to control mosquitoes because they are such a nuisance in Southern California, as well as they are pestiferous vectoring diseases. With the advent of Silent Spring, we of course have been pressured to reduce our impact on the environment through use of chemical and biological pesticides. And society has really been trying to pressure us to get away from making such a big impact as we did earlier in the last century. Usually we use Gambusia affinis, the mosquito fish, to try and help out and control mosquitoes. And this larvivorous fish has been greatly used across this country. However, it does have the negative impacts of degrading our natural fish populations by outcompeting them because it does breed all year round. Our lab has been particularly interested with Gila orchidae. It's the arroyo chub and is a species of special concern in California. This is because of the fact that it is only native to four river systems in San Diego, Riverside, and Los Angeles counties. It is found in both the fast-flowing parts of the streams as well as the backwater pools, and we thought that this would make it a great addition to use instead of Gambusia. Previous work in our lab by Alex Van Dam, who's currently at Davis, found that Gila was as effective as Gambusia in an unvegetated system. When you throw them out into a bunch of wading pools and you don't have any vegetation in there, Gila can gobble up just as many larvae as Gambusia can. We also have found by David Popko, who's a technician in our lab, that Gambusia is relatively ineffective in a very vegetated system, and this is because Gambusia will not swim between the vegetation stands. We do also know from the natural history of Gila, the arroyo chub, that it is more tolerant of hypoxic water than other proposed replacement species. And this is important when you're looking at wastewater treatment wetlands because they do have algal blooms that drive down the amount of oxygen that's in the water. So the objectives of this study were to see, of course, is Gila a good replacement for the mosquito fish when it comes to a vegetated wetland system? And because I'm actually coming from a background of aquatic invertebrate ecology, I also wanted to see what happens to the rest of the invertebrates that are in that community. I won't be talking much about that today, but I will mention it a little bit at the end. Our study design is this took place at the UCR Aquatic Research Facility in 12 4x7 meter squared ponds. We used two vegetation patterns that you can see on the screen and three vegetation plot sizes. A single pot of the Chenoplectus californicus, the California bulrush, is about a tenth of a meter squared plot, and we had 12 of those in each of the wetlands. That's not what I wanted to do. We also had a 4 meter plot size, which were four pots pushed together, and a 0.9 meter plot size, which were nine pots pushed together. This